from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to Washington Watch. This is Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Wednesday afternoon. It is the 26th of February, 2020. Coming up on today's show, in the chaotic scream fest that was the last Democratic presidential debate before the South Carolina primary, candidates were in a scramble to make a move, most of them against frontrunner Bernie Sanders. My first guest is Jim Garrity, senior political correspondent for National Review, who in his most recent piece likened last night to the political equivalent of the movie Get Shorty. He'll give me his thoughts on the winners, the losers, and the upcoming primary for Democratic candidates. In my second block, presidential candidates Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren yet again made notable and selective use of scripture during the Democratic debate last night. But did they use it correctly, and is there incongruence between what they say and what they believe? FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Clausen, helps me break down their statements. At the bottom of the hour, the left has a stranglehold on big tech, the Senate chamber, and the legacy media, but corporations are fast becoming a threat to free enterprise and the shareholders' actual interests by pushing donations to groups like Planned Parenthood, even while they fail to benefit from the abortion industrial complex themselves. Justin Danhof, general counsel for the National Center for Public Policy Research and director of its Free Enterprise Project, joins me to discuss his recent piece in Breitbart. And in our last block, several states have introduced bills this year to prohibit certain surgical and hormonal treatments for minors that would help facilitate a child's gender transition. Earlier today in the Alabama State House, the Vulnerable Child Compassion and Protection Act was discussed in a public hearing. Our senior fellow for policy studies, Peter Sprague, was there and joins me to talk about it. As a reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Follow us on Twitter at FRCDC, me at Sarah P. Perry, or Tony at T. Perkins. TonyPerkins.com will have information and resources on today's issues and guests so that you can get a handle on all the information we'll cover today. And as a reminder, you can also register there for the upcoming Israel trip in June, led by FRC. Well, last night the Democratic debates came down south, and they continued their hunt for the nomination. Unfortunately, the South Carolina debate was more a shouting match than a political debate, and much of the candidates' rhetoric focused on putting sights on Bernie Sanders and getting him on defense after he recently doubled down on his Fidel Castro comments. So joining me now with his analysis is senior political correspondent of National Review, Jim Garrity. Jim, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
So of the winners and losers in yesterday's debate, who emerged on top and who fell to the bottom in your estimation?
Well, clearly the biggest winners of the night were people who chose to watch something else, because it turned out to be really nearly 2 hours of all seven candidates trying to talk over each other, shouting over each other. It was, I don't want to beat up on the moderators for CBS News too much, because this is a tough job. You have seven people off on that stage. Four, Steyer is, you know, play acting. I guess he's kind of in some sort of fantasy camp for billionaires who want to pretend that they're presidential candidates. but the other, you know, for Klobuchar and for Buttigieg and for everybody whose name isn't Bloomberg, Biden, or Sanders, you're really in deep trouble now. And they really needed to make a splash. And they, each one wanted to jump in on every question. And they really desperately needed to have some sort of dramatic moment that would turn into the sort of thing that gets shared all over YouTube and social media the next day. It's tough to moderate that. Unfortunately, I don't think they rose to the occasion, and it just turned into noise. The transcript was just, you know, the word in parentheses, crosstalk.
Right.
Over and over again. So,
crosstalk, so overtalk, ultimate chaos, all of the above.
And
so I've got a question. I've got a question
right.
for you. So we've got a Democratic socialist. Okay, I'm going to use air quotes here because really once a socialist, always a socialist, and in all contexts. Sanders refuses to back away from his comments in praise of Fidel Castro's success in enhancing educational literacy in the country of Cuba. And I have to stifle a laugh because, again, it was education designed specifically for literacy toward indoctrination. In other words, read this communist manifesto, but you have to learn to read first. So I want to play some audio because last night, again, refusing to back away, he actually did not offer any clarification. He said this.
Cuba made progress on education. Occasionally, it might be good idea to be honest about American foreign policy. And that includes the fact that America has overthrown governments all over the world, in Chile, in Guatemala, in Iran. And when dictatorships, whether it is the Chinese or the Cubans, do something good, you acknowledge that.
Okay, so Van Jones followed up on CNN, former Obama advisor, obviously, so he has certain perspectives. He had this today over Sanders' comments, thinking it was a missed opportunity.
I was disappointed with Bernie's answer on the socialism question. He had to know that was coming. There's no reason to do a big retrospective, nostalgia, scream fest about authoritarian regimes from the 70s. There was an opportunity for Bernie to clarify the American people. That when he says democratic socialism, that's the point. It's not that stuff from Cuba. It's not that stuff from Soviet Union. It's the stuff that you see in Northern Europe that's working well for normal people, and they vote all the time.
Now, notwithstanding the fact that these Nordic countries that Van Jones is referencing are not truly socialist, but perhaps a better terminology would be compassionately capitalist, do you think Sanders missed an opportunity to actually give himself an edge going into South Carolina by not saying, I am condemning these authoritarian rules and these dictatorships?
Yeah, a couple times during the night when he really got backed into a corner, he kept insisting that he has always denounced authoritarian regimes. And I think everyone wanted to yell at their screens either a barnyard epithet or no, you haven't, because if every time the topic of an authoritarian regime that happens to be socialist and its economics comes up for topic, you're first leaning forward, jumping in a chair, but let's give them credit for the literacy, you know. Like, maybe you make this pro forma denunciation. But I going back, I was so stunned by how emphatic he was and how he stuck by it in that CNN town hall. But I went back and I looked. Do you know what the literacy rate in pre-Castro Cuba was?
Oh, I'd like to know.
76%. That's not that bad.
Right? It's not.
So you think, right? And so you get it up, and oh, by the way, it's very prosperous, and oh, by the way, they had a pretty good education system. They had a pretty good income. Was it perfect? No. Was the Batista regime all that democratic? Probably not. But the idea that in Bernie Sanders' mind, going from 76% literacy to 90-some percent literacy balances out the death squads, the secret police, the political prisoners. No free elections.
Right.
No free sweep.
Right.
If you want to improve literacy, set up a literacy program. Exactly. You don't need to say, well, look, first we have to establish this brutal dictatorship, and then we can really make, you know, get back on that, you know, 20-some percent improvement of that. And as you know, I posted a bit about this on Twitter, and everybody's like, you know, all those death squads, they probably, you know, eliminated a bunch of the illiterate people. So that probably brought up the rate a little bit there by itself.
Right. Now, my thinking, I'm looking at the MSNBC polling numbers, and take that polling accuracy for what you will, but four Super Tuesday polls they actually published last night, California, Texas, Virginia, and North Carolina, they have Sanders leading. So in your estimation, is this our presumptive Democratic nominee?
Yes, I could go into a lot of details. And I think the one thing that's worth noting, in particular when it comes to some of these states like California, you get a certain amount for how well you do in the statewide vote, and also you get a certain delegate depending on how you did in each congressional district. So my hope is that they finish counting the votes in California by the time the convention is in Milwaukee. It's going to take a while. But
right.
All the indications are that Bloomberg's going to do pretty well. And I think probably for all the Super Tuesday states, there are about 15 of them, Sanders is probably the only candidate who's going to get at least some delegates out of all of them, which may well give him a lead that's going to be very tough to overtake.
Do you think Buttigieg and Klobuchar have sort of seen the end of the line?
Yeah, and you've seen a lot of complaints for a couple of cycles about Iowa and New Hampshire going first. Because I don't live in either of those states, I don't think they should go first. I'd much prefer Virginia go first because I live here.
Right.
But if not that, let's make some other, you know, let's rotate. Let's find some other variety of giving other states. They're, you know, looking back at this, they are I think Iowa is like 3% African American. New Hampshire is like 1.5% African American. You know, in a Democratic primary, that matters, right? Here's a big chunk of the party. That, you know, there's about 9% in Nevada, and then finally you get to South Carolina, where the African American proportion of the people who show up in a Democratic primary, and you know, South Carolina is a fairly Republican state, but they have a decent number of Democrats down there, gets up to 40%, right? So if you're Joe Biden, you're like, hey, this is my demographic. These are the folks who are most loyal to me, most likely to vote for me. You've had to wait through three states and 3 weeks of, ugh, what a terrible finish, till you get to a group to see that. I think this might be the last cycle in which those states go first. And I think you look at Klobuchar and Buttigieg, and those, you know, they are well tailored for those states. They did very well in those states. And then they went to Nevada and nothing, you know.
Right.
Neither one's like they're going to do well in South Carolina. And other than Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar's home state, I don't know where they do all that much better in the Super Tuesday states.
Well, she's got a likability, you know, she's sort of the realist, the pragmatist, you know, she's sort of everybody's measured school marm. I appreciate her demeanor when the rest of the candidates are screaming at one another, but I do think, you know, as you brought up, she sort of had her day. I'm looking at Sanders, I'm looking at him at a Trump-Sanders matchup. How do you think that fares?
For if you're a Trump fan and you're rooting for Trump's reelection, the good news is it is really not hard to see a scenario where Trump beats him like a drum, where the economy is doing really well, where Americans who are not comfortable with Trump and what the things he says, the way he treats people, the rants on Twitter, all that kind of stuff, all of that stuff. A lot of people say, look, I can't do that, but I don't want to elect a socialist. I don't want to mess up the economic good times we're having. Bernie, but there's stuff in Bernie Sanders' background where he talks about how he believes cancer has a psychosomatic element to it. And, oh, by the way, this is not some, oh, crazy teenager stuff. Bernie Sanders was 47 years old when he said this. Right?
Yes.
Bernie Sanders has crazy stuff, and stuff was not the first word that came to mind, that has come out of his mouth for decades. And so the idea, you know, like, and the Democrats would have to defend all of it. So all of a sudden, Trump's crazy Twitter rants don't seem quite so bad.
No, they
when
don't.
You've got the, yeah. Let me tell you why you have cancer. You know, you're thinking wrong. You know, it's just the idea that just you it's hard to imagine how that could do it. Having said that, look, we're a roughly 50-50 country. I have no idea how coronavirus is going to shake out in the coming months. The economy could go into, you know, not have such good times if the global economy slows down. Maybe Bernie Sanders could win, and then we end up with a socialist president, and, you know, folks like me are very nervous about that. So.
Well, and then there's no point moving to Canada either because we won't fare any better. So I guess we all just get together and pray.
We'll be yearning for the economic conservatism of Justin Trudeau.
You got it. Jim Garrity, senior political correspondent at National Review Online. Loved talking to you today. Thanks for talking with me on Washington Watch. Well, coming up next, we heard more interesting, selective, notable use of scripture among candidates Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren. So are they saying and doing the same things? David Claussen, director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, joins me next on Washington Watch.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemical-abortion.
China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at FRCblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at FRCblog.com.
What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, President of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
We all need to be lectured sometimes.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Wednesday, the 26th of February, 2020. TonyPerkins.com is our website. Go there. You can see all of today's podcast resources. And one of our special links will be for the Israel trip that we are leading June 2nd to the 12th. Michelle Bachmann, Tony Perkins, Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin will take you on a tour of the Holy Land, and you won't want to miss it. Well, again, some sort of selective use of scripture to promote a political message and probably to expand what they feel is, or sense after last night, a rapidly shrinking base. A few of the candidates, in between yelling at each other, used scripture. So I'm joined right now by FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Clausen, who will help me sort of break down these statements. Welcome back, David.
Great to be here with you, Sarah.
Okay, so before we get to these particular scriptural statements, I found it very interesting that Elizabeth Warren focused on a comment that Bloomberg had allegedly made in the past. So walk us through that real quick.
Yeah, that's right. So in between all the shouting that took place in last night's debate, it was really interesting that Elizabeth Warren really zeroed in on former Mayor Michael Bloomberg, kind of like she did a week ago. But she really tried to take him to task on an alleged comment he made in 1997. And I have the Warren quote in front of me. She says, "At least I didn't have a boss who said to me, 'Kill it,' the way that Mayor Bloomberg is alleged to have said." And to be fair, Mayor Bloomberg emphatically denied it. He's denied this. And the New York Times says that this is something that, you know, allegedly happened in 1997.
Right.
Bloomberg denies it. There's a witness who says that they did hear it. So I don't think we can determine whether it happened or not. But it's regardless of that, it's really interesting that the day that her colleagues in the United States Senate voted against two bills, the Pain Capable Bill and the Born Alive Survivor Protection Act, the day that she's making these comments in South Carolina is when her colleagues voted against these common sense bills that would protect the most vulnerable in our society.
Right. From infanticide, of all things. So, indeed, they were actually promoting a message of kill it, even as Warren exhibited disgust at alleged comments by Michael Bloomberg. So, I find that incredulous and hypocritical. But let's go specifically to those statements that they made about scripture. So, I have a first clip from Pete Buttigieg. Let's listen to what he said.
I seek to live by the teachings that say that if you would be a leader, you must first be a servant. And, of course, the teaching, not unique to the Christian tradition, but a big part of it, that holds that we are to treat others as we would be treated.
Okay, not to be outdone, Elizabeth Warren chimed in with a verse from Matthew 25. Let's listen to what she said.
Matthew 25, and that is, "Inasmuch as ye hath done it unto one of these, the least of thy brethren, ye hath done it unto me."
Boy, this seems to be sort of a repetitive use of the word in an election that has been promoting anything but what you and I would consider biblical values, isn't it?
That's true, Sarah. And I want to be happy. Like, part of me wants to be happy that they're quoting scripture. Maybe they're reading their Bibles, because as Christians, we know 2 Timothy 3:16 says all scripture is breathed out by God,
yes,
and profitable for teaching, for reproof, correction, and for training in righteousness. And the references that they're quoting there, and those were in their closing statements, Warren quoting Matthew 25:40, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for the least of my brothers, you did to me." And then Mayor Pete juxtaposing two verses, again from the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew 20:26, and then Matthew 7:12 at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. You know, part of me wants to be happy about that, but the problem is it just rings so hollow when you listen to them quoting Scripture and then you compare it to their record. It just rings hollow when Senator Warren quotes a passage of Scripture that underscores an imperative to care for the most vulnerable in society, when she's publicly opposed every meaningful piece of legislation that would protect the rights of not just the unborn, but of recently born children.
Right.
And she's on record of voting against the Born Alive Protection Act. She did that last year. And then Mayor Pete, again, it's difficult to square his professed love for Scripture when he continues to twist and distort the Bible's clear teaching on life to advance an agenda that is antithetical to the teachings of Scripture.
Well, it brings to mind exactly the verse she cited, which is, "Onto the least of these." And arguably, aren't the unborn, aren't the youngest of children, those who survive abortion, those who are capable of feeling pain, those two bills yesterday were about the least of these. And we were seeking to protect them. The Republicans in the Senate lifted a yeoman's burden to try to get this legislation passed. And yet they voted against it anyway.
They did. And just to be clear, the title of that bill yesterday was the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which would ban late-term abortion when science has shown that babies can feel pain.
Yes.
And then the other bill, the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, just would require basic medical care to be provided to babies who survive botched abortions. These are babies lying there on the table that are alive.
They are, yes.
And Senator Warren voted against both of these pieces of legislation in 2018 and then 2019. And her colleagues in the Senate, the day she's at this debate, made sure that this bill did not advance in the United States Senate.
You know, I have to mention one thing, particularly about Mayor Pete. You know, he's citing Scripture on the one hand, and then on the other hand, in the previous CNN town hall held just days before we went to the pre-South Carolina primary debates, he's telling us that he wants to remove tax-exempt status for individuals operating in accordance with their sincerely held beliefs if they discriminate against someone else. Well, again, our beliefs are not to be relegated just to the church, just to our homes, to our living rooms. If we practice our beliefs, if we believe what we say, we exercise it in the public square. He doesn't seem to get that.
He doesn't get it just like Beto O'Rourke when he said that he would take the tax-exempt status away from churches. But, yeah, what Mayor Pete's doing, if his policies were enacted, churches, universities, charities, hospitals that have sincerely held beliefs about marriage and human sexuality would lose all of this federal funding, and that's dangerous.
It is dangerous. I'm so glad that you were able to help us break it down a little bit. I anticipate that as this campaign continues, as we inch toward November, we will hear more of this scriptural political speak, as it were, because this is something that clearly resonates, or they hope it will. FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Clausen, has been my guest today. Coming up in the next segment, you have known that corporations are using your money in ways they see fit, but do you know precisely where it's going? Justin Danoff of the Free Enterprise Project at the National Center for Public Policy Research will join me to discuss his recent op-ed in Breitbart and what he's learned about where the money's actually going. Coming up next on Washington Watch. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Wednesday afternoon. Well, I would like to know why Planned Parenthood seems to have a foothold on corporations that don't benefit from abortion business. Why are corporations, multinational corporations, billions at their disposals, why are they sending money to organizations like Planned Parenthood when, in fact, they don't stand to endure any direct benefit? Joining me to talk about this and his new Breitbart op-ed, "Corporations Are Killing Their Customers Literally," is general counsel for the National Center of Public Policy Research and director of the Center's Free Enterprise Project, Justin Danhof. Justin, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Sarah. It's always great to talk with you, even if the topic is a little depressing today.
It is a little depressing. Listen, I got to start out by saying that you are an individual, and yours is an organization that has really found a vacuum fast filling with individual corporate actors who are all too willing to take the money of their shareholders and send it someplace else. So you write about Planned Parenthood specifically, and 180 CEOs last year signing a full-page ad calling pro-life legislation that was pending at the time bad for business. But these corporations don't have anything directly to do with abortion industry. So why the interest in the abortion industrial complex?
Yeah, so as you point out, outside of the disgusting abortion industrial complex, there are a number of corporations that support the left on this movement, and they are against life. And they're some of the biggest companies in the United States of America. And it's for a couple of reasons. First of all, many of them are run by liberal social justice warrior CEOs to start with. But outside of that, the pressure that comes in the form of liberal stakeholders that promote abortion is very, very strong. And you would think that with the background of what we just laid out, more than three dozen companies fund Planned Parenthood directly, right? 180 CEOs say pro-life legislation is bad for business. First of all, we need some reporters to start asking those CEOs why killing your potential future customers is good for business. That's a question I really want directed at those CEOs. You would think that they would be satisfied with their status in corporate America, and I'm talking about these activists. Well, you'd be wrong. What I found out is that this year, for the first time since 1973, investor advocates are actually going to corporations and demanding that they get on board, demanding that they, quote unquote, make the business case for abortion. Mm. And so there's five of these shareholder resolutions backed by the As You Sow Network right now, including one in front of Macy's and including one in front of Progressive. And again, the message is clear from these proposals. Get into the abortion debate, get on our side, or we're coming after you. And what's it all about in the end, Sarah? It's all about money and speech, right? The left likes to silence conservative and Christian voices because they don't want to debate us and they don't like what we have to say.
That's it.
So the goal, the first step here, and they make this very clear in the articles written about this, they make the goal clear that they first want companies to make pro-abortion statements. But then, once they get them on record supporting abortion, they made their next goal very clear. They're going to go after your corporate PAC funding. And if they find funding for any pro-life legislator, they're going to hammer that corporation. So the goal, again, is to silence political speech that the left doesn't like, because there's nothing they enjoy more than silencing their political opponents and their policy opponents.
You quoted Alan Pierce of Trillion Asset Management, who said in your article, in your quote here, it's kind of like companies almost have to take a stance, and just trying to be neutral is something that you can't really do. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely not. Look at this proposal that they've got to Macy's. Macy's is closing hundreds of stores and firing thousands of employees at the moment. They don't need to spend time getting involved in the abortion debate when it has nothing germane to do to the bottom line of their company, which is suffering dramatically right now. We think that they should stay neutral in this culture war because it doesn't affect their bottom line. The only problem is the tipping point comes when they're only hearing from liberals, when they're only hearing from pro-abortion advocates. It eventually becomes easy just to appease the activists if they're not hearing from pro-life Americans. So if you shop at Macy's, if you are an investor in Macy's, reach out to them and let them know that you oppose this resolution, that you think the company should just continue to sell goods that folks want and, frankly, do a better job of it so that they don't fire more employees and close more stores.
We got about a minute left here, Justin. Tell me about As You Sow. I'm assuming this is a name that we and our listeners need to be aware of in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So As You Sow is the umbrella organization under which all of these groups on the left that engage in investor activism operate. So anywhere from the unions to Trillium Asset Management, these are asset managers. We have state pension funds in liberal states like California and New York that are part of this organization. I write about them a lot. Come to nationalcenter.org, our website, and you can help track what they're doing. And I really appreciate the time today, Sarah.
Nationalcenter.org, you heard the website. Friends, listen to Justin when he has things to say on this. He comes from an experienced background and is doing what not a lot of us are, so maybe we should join him. Justin Danhof, General Counsel for the National Center for Public Policy Research. Coming up next, I've got Peter Sprigg, FRC Senior Fellow for Policy Studies, on a bill that passed out of two legislative committees today and is headed toward a full vote. The topic? Protecting minor kids from life-altering surgeries on their gender. We'll be right back after this on Washington Watch.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemical-abortion.
China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, President of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. This is Sarah Perry. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins today. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Go also to your favorite podcast platform. You can find Washington Watch there. And for more information on our upcoming Israel trip, again, TonyPerkins.com. You won't want to miss it. Well, several states have caught what might be called a flu of common sense, and House legislative chambers have introduced bills to prohibit certain physical procedures that alter the normal sexual development of a minor child for purposes of facilitating a gender transition. Well, these laws would also ban the use of puberty-blocking drugs, cross-sex hormones, or gender reassignment surgery in minors, but many do permit the encouragement, the use of mental health counseling and psychotherapy, as is appropriate. Now, earlier today, one of these bills, the Vulnerable Child Compassion and Protection Act, was discussed in a public hearing in the Alabama State House and passed out of two legislative committees, which means it is headed for a House vote. Joining me now is FRC's Senior Fellow for Policy Studies, Peter Sprigg, who was present for the hearing. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you, Sarah. Good to be with you.
So you were there. You were there during the public hearing. Testimony was offered for and against. Tell me a little bit about the mood in the room.
Yes, I was there, and I actually, my written testimony was submitted in the House
committee hearing, the House Health Committee, and I did get the opportunity to testify in person before the Senate Health Committee. So I was happy to be able to share at least an abbreviated version of my written testimony, which I understand is now posted on the FRC website. So
yes, it is.
That there as well. The room was packed. Both the House hearing was held first, and then kind of almost everybody went up one floor to the Senate hearing room, and many of the same people testified, and many people showing their support. It was divided. The pro transgender forces did turn out, but there was a very good turnout as well from what is being called the Compassion Coalition in Alabama. The women of the Alabama Eagle Forum were among the leaders of this coalition in this state, and did a great job pulling together really an all-star lineup of witnesses to testify in favor of this bill. We had physicians, we had, you know, a pediatrician, an endocrinologist, a plastic surgeon, all testifying in favor of it. And we also had detransitioners, people who had once been transgender themselves and came out of the transgender lifestyle. We had a Walt Heyer, who is a good friend of FRC, who's 79 years old. We had a woman who's more middle aged, and we had a young woman who's just in her early 20s who was on cross-sex hormones for a year at the age of 18. So we had a tremendous variety of witnesses really testifying to the harm that these medical procedures do, and we're very grateful that in both the House and Senate committees they responded to that by recommending passage of the bill. So both the House of Representatives and the Senate in Alabama have now referred this to a floor vote, which should take place in a couple of weeks.
Well, you've been there on the ground. You've been talking with the leaders of the encouragement of this common sense bill. Minors, and you've written on this, Peter, and we're so desperate for reminders of the fact that minors cannot commit themselves to contracts. They cannot vote. They cannot drink alcohol. And yet the legislation of the sort that's just passed out of these legislative committees in Alabama is of a kind that we find ourselves needing because of this widespread push to hurry children into gender transition as part of a coordinated progressive agenda. Such a tiny, tiny minority of the population. Minor percentages, portions of percentages, pushing an extreme, radical, life-altering series of treatments for these minor kids. It just makes good sense. But you're there, you're on the ground. What are you hearing about the likelihood of passage in the House and Senate of this bill?
Well, I would have to think, based on the response in committee, that the likelihood is good. I think I didn't get the exact roll call. I believe in the House committee it was a party line vote. There were four, I think all four Democrats on that committee voted against the bill. In the Senate, however, there was bipartisan support. There was actually at least one Democrat who had voted in favor of this bill. And I understood from some conversations afterwards that senator is a pharmacist, is himself a pharmacist, so he has some understanding of the medical issues involved as well. So I think that it looks good. I hope that our opponents are not able to do anything to sort of poison the well before floor vote, but we're feeling good about the prospects for this bill on the floor of both houses. There was one amendment made to the bill. The primary section of the bill had the prohibition on these medical interventions prohibiting the use of puberty-blocking drugs, cross-sex hormones, or gender reassignment surgery for minors, which in Alabama is anyone under the age of 19.
Right.
there is a second section of the bill that was designed to protect parental rights in relation to schools and to prohibit schools from concealing a child's professed transgender identity from the parents. We have heard anecdotal evidence of children who actually will transition at school without their parents' knowledge or consent, and this would prohibit that. Well, there was some concern about the implications for educators, so that part of the bill was softened a little bit by amendment. The sponsors accepted the amendment to make sure that it was restricting only information with respect to this topic, with respect to gender identity, not sort of all information about what a child may disclose at school, but and also to remove the actual criminal penalties that were included in the bill that could have been imposed on educators. So that education section was softened a little bit, but we didn't feel that that was enough to withdraw support for it. And I think maybe that it's possible that may improve the chances of success on the floor.
Yes. Now, not the first bill of its kind. In fact, we're seeing quite a number of these bills popping up all over the country, which we find encouraging here. But tell me about some of the other states and what we're seeing in terms of legislative efforts to protect these minor vulnerable kids.
Yes. Well, we were, of course, the first state that actually voted on one of these bills was South Dakota, which a few weeks ago their House of Representatives passed the bill by a large margin, by a 2-to-1 margin, but went to a Senate committee, and there was some resistance in the Senate committee, and unfortunately the bill was defeated in Senate committee, which means that doesn't mean that it can't be brought up again, but it requires kind of an elaborate parliamentary maneuver, which is very difficult. So it's not exactly dead, but it's kind of on life support in South Dakota. And that was partly because the Republican Governor Kristi Noem, behind the scenes, expressed her reluctance. Well, actually, publicly she expressed reluctance to support the bill. Our understanding is behind the scenes she expressed opposition to it, and so that was not helpful. Mm-hmm. We are hopeful that Governor Kay Ivey here in Alabama will not do something similar, although I'm not aware that she's taken a public position on this bill. But so South Dakota already acted, but there are a number of other states, as you said, that have introduced these. I think Georgia, as far as our contact with some of these state-level activists is concerned, I think Georgia is perhaps the state that has the best organized effort on this score. But there's reports that there may be as many as 9 to 11 states that are looking at this type of legislation this year in this session.
This has been sort of a pet issue for some of the candidates on the campaign trail right now, as far as the Dems are concerned. Warren even stating that she would go so far as to work with a transgendered child in the Department of Education to be able to provide advice and perspective on educational policies. Are people starting to see this as more a human rights issue, or do they continue to see this as sort of a politically divisive issue because the Democratic candidates continue to reiterate these talking points?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think the attitude of the Democratic presidential candidates it certainly wasn't brought up in the hearing, even by those who were critical of the bill. And I'm not aware that really played any role. One thing that we have emphasized with respect to this bill, although some opponents are portraying it as sort of a radical, intervention, it's actually quite modest because it targets only these physical interventions and only for minors. So this bill does nothing to prevent children, for example, from going through what's called a social transition.
Mm-hmm.
Children are free to, with the support of their parents, to change the way they wear their hair, to change the style of clothing they wear, to change their name. to ask their local school to identify them as the opposite sex and so forth. Nothing in this bill would prevent that at all. Nothing in this bill would prevent adults who have reached the age of majority from being able to have these radical medical transitions or medical procedures themselves if they choose to as adults. So this is narrowly targeted at radical medical interventions that harm the bodies of children, of minors, who, as you were kind of indicating, I think, earlier, really are not capable of giving informed consent to this kind of procedure.
Right.
So I think I'm hopeful that because of the relatively limited scope of this bill, it will not be caught up in sort of the larger issues of LGBT rights. In fact, I just had the privilege of helping a documentary filmmaker with an interview with one of our witnesses, Sydney, the young woman who actually went on testosterone to try to become a man for a year before she stopped it because of the terrible side effects she was experiencing. Now, Sydney is actually a lesbian and still identifies as a lesbian. She made clear that she's not opposing this bill because she's not supporting this bill because she's against the LGBT community. She's
right.
Part of the LGBT community,
right.
But she opposes it because of the physical harm that it causes to the bodies of transgender kids.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. You and I have talked about this both on air and off air, but I think this is where we find a lot of the burgeoning sort of cross-political coalition among unlikely allies. You know, conservative women like myself, we've worked with organizations like the Women's Liberation Front, who, though avowed feminists, come to the table with conservative women and say, listen, we do agree on this. We know what the biological scientific definition of a woman is. And if you expand, alter, change, or claim to be able to modify the actual reality of sexual identity, biology itself for a woman, you erase us from legal and protected status. Decades of federal legislation to protect our right to compete equally in our own athletics, to be compensated equally, to protect us when we are pregnant from discrimination. All these bills for working so hard, 50 years of progress. And again, we find ourselves at a position in America where we are having to pick a side on what science actually means. Peter, we are so grateful for your good work. We appreciate what you've done down there. Are you next up to perhaps take a nap after all of this testimony?
Well, you know what? I may try to run by the headquarters of our old nemesis, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is just a few blocks away from where I am in Montgomery, Alabama.
Well, and you can hold up a copy of Tyler O'Neill's new book, Making Hate Pay, that we discussed on yesterday's show. So there we are, ladies and gentlemen, a full circle series of Washington Watches for the week. Peter Sprague, Senior Fellow for Policy Studies at Family Research Council, thanks for all the work you're doing down there on behalf of vulnerable kids. This is Washington Watch. As a reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. You can also find Peter's testimony in support of the Alabama Vulnerable Child Compassion and Protection Act at FRC.org, where he cites some incredibly compelling statistics, which you won't often hear from mainstream media outlets, if at all. And it's a story. It is a fact that we need to be repeating, because those of you who are listening who are parents, this is an issue that we need to make much hay about. This will play significantly in the upcoming election. So we encourage you not only to be informed, but to act on the information, make decisions that support the values of faith, family, and freedom. But in the meantime, I am Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins, and I'll be with you next time on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported.
Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234.